I want you to all know Mrs. Marilyn Dunbar. Somebody says, why don't you ever introduce your wife? My wife is, she likes to hide out and doesn't want to be introduced. You know, house members' wives have a very important function in the Holy Land. You know, they're the only ones that when you come out of a dinner party or something, would lean over and say to you, did you really mean to say that in the middle, front of everybody? Kind of remind you of who you are, you know? She hasn't said too much during this meeting. I must be getting along all right here. Friends, what is this called, Q&A? Q&E, quiz and examine, huh? Okay. Well, friends, you know, I kind of wore myself out yesterday with four hours of presentation. You may think I'm Superman, but I'm not. So I'll see if I can address myself to some questions, and you'll be patient if I don't have any answers. And yes, please.
I wonder if you could answer this in your knowledge of the Guardian, who was very, very careful in his selection of words. And I wonder why he chose the title, God Passes By.
You know, as far as I know, this title was suggested by George Townsend to him. It's quite literally that, you know, we have Pips Passes By was an earlier version of that in English literature. And the idea God passes by, it is God passes by. I mean, that we're talking yesterday about the day of God and the implications of Baha'u'llah being the closest reflection of the Godhead that we've ever have any historical knowledge of in this planet. So in a sense, it's like that. But it is, try to translate it into Spanish or something. It becomes difficult. Dios pasa. Where did he go, you know? yes, please.
There is much said about unity. But when you put that in cultural context, I find that what one person's disunity is projected is somebody else's unity. So within the faith, in a functional level, where are we headed toward unity that is free of cultural prejudice and bias?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd refer back to the comment I made yesterday about Horace Holly saying, you know, unity is not a decision on our part to get along with each other. It's the illumination that we receive directly in our relationship with Baha'u'llah. It causes us to be attracted to each other and bonded to each other in a world community. So the solution is that transcends then the cultural differences. If we stay at that level, we're going to have lots of difficulties. But if we see reflected in each other the image and likeness of God, which is there and in potential, if not fully manifested, we should be able to love each other, and love each other would be the basis of the unity rather than some decision to kind of cooperate. Please.
Just two areas of interest, only if you feel like speaking about them, but one would be if you could comment on the value of you serving in the Holy Land, and secondly, if you felt me to share any recollections of Surya Hanum and her relationship to the Universal House of Justice.
Mm-hmm. The youth program goes on there at the World Center. There's a constant need for a flow of youth. I think that there are more offers of youth to come than can be recognized and accepted. So if you know some youth that have offered to go and they haven't been accepted, it's just because the quota was filled for that period or that year when they might be coming, and they can always reapply and so on. But basically, there's a flow of youth, especially just out of high school, that help with cleaning and maintenance, that help with security all over the place, and that help with the gardening. And as you can imagine, there's lots of tasks to do in those areas, and they learn discipline. Some of them come, they've never had a job before, and faced with a lot of challenges. And they work together with youth from all over the world, 70 other countries represented when we left. So you really are exposed to all kinds of different cultures, and it's like a world tour, mini pioneer world tour, you know. And how do we get along with other cultures? If you're talking about these cultural differences, the World Center is the one place where you have to transcend all that. And sometimes, you know, the kids come and there's four of them in an apartment and they've got four different cultures and four different approaches to kitchens. And some have come and they've never been in a kitchen. And others come and they don't know what it's for. Vacuum cleaners present an interesting challenge. They're terrific kids and they're devoted, but they've where they come from, those things were not part of life and culture. And that's a challenge to the, I mean, a lot of the kids come and they have a stipend allowance when they're there. It's more money they've ever seen in their whole life. So the house has a terrific job balancing this out. You can't say, well, the ones that come from poor countries we won't give as much to for their allowance. There's no way to do that. And so they have to mature fairly quickly. And some of them are so lonely and they've got a telephone in their apartment. And first thing you know, they have a couple $100 in telephone fees hanging over their heads. So we had to work out different things too. So there's a warning to them, you know, this is building up, or when after your phone has spent this much between the four of you, it'll be turned off or something. So it was all kinds of, you can only imagine the challenges that the youth face. So in a year period, or 18 months, or 2.5 years that they come, they have a tremendous experience. And I would say generally it's a bonding experience, but then I was right close with the youth with this weekly class that I had. Now they have this program of the Divine Plan, and a number of the house members have opportunities to meet with youth in smaller settings. And I think surely everything will be going forth. The few youth that I'm still in touch with from the World Center seem to be in fine shape. So I would say it's a wonderful opportunity and experience. And sometimes maybe somebody's not ready to go when they're just out of high school. Maybe they need a break out of their college studies, you know, where 1 year they take off and they go to the World Center and do something. Generally, the youth find they can focus better on what they want to do in their life after an experience like that. And they make friends from all over the world, and they all stay in touch. A lot of them stay in touch through emails, you know. We have a Papua New Guinean tribesman who was helping in our gardens, a dear man, about that tall. And he now is on Skype and sends us Skype messages. A wonderful fellow. About Rhea Kahneman, her relation to the House of Justice, what can you say? She did everything she could to bring the House of Justice into being. She knew that was what had to happen. And with all of the hands, they support the House of Justice. And they realize the unity of the cause and the whole future of the cause is dependent on the House of Justice. So they constantly make reference to that. Sometimes when she was meeting with us, she'd have a few other things to say, but she was a very frank woman and very forward in her guidance and her thoughts. But it was always wonderful when we could meet with her, and we met with her both independent of the teaching center, and sometimes when the teaching center would come several times a year, we'd have a joint session with the teaching center to talk about the future of the cause and what was going on. Yeah. Let's see, I think you were next, yeah.
Talk about one of the forces of darkness, I guess humanity is replacing God with materialism. And briefly, I think you talk about can you speak about the law of Kulbadan, how that might address as a force of light? What are the forces of light to combat this force of darkness?
Well, I think as we grow in spirituality and want to obey the laws of the faith, certainly Okukula is there to be reckoned with and to start fulfilling. And it's clear from the writings that the payment of Okukula cleanses our material possessions and wealth. I think already if you do pay Okukula, it shows a certain detachment from the material world, just by the nature of it, you know. Now he says, if you're not joyful in paying it, don't pay it. It's an obligation, but he doesn't want it squeezed out of the people, you know, so to speak. It kind of negates the whole spirit of the business if it comes that way. So it's good to read the compilation from time to time and realize the spirit that Baha'u'llah invites this. What a bounty of God that he has provided this means whereby you can feel that you can enjoy the rest of your possessions and your wealth. I mean, apart from the IRS, of course, and things like that. Please.
Yes, I was talking to Fred Schenker, because I know you've been involved with translating some of the Baha'i books, and I said, is Mr. Dunbar been involved with any of the books you know? He said, well, what about the Kitabi Akdas? I said, oh yeah, great, but I know you, could you share with us the books you've been involved in the translation of with the committees, and any stories of how that's done, and stories of translating. Anyway, thank you for taking that job, too.
I was
the Divine Mysteries, I think of you, because I know that was one of your...
I hope I wasn't too big an obstacle for the book. First of all, I think we should correct that I wasn't involved in the translation of books. I was involved in the revision of the translations. There's one that's a big step from one to the other. And examining as one could, the originals in the light of the translations that had been produced, and then making suggestions and having revisions take place. And I was always involved in that as part of a committee. That was the first committee that the House appointed me to. To my great astonishment, we came on the House of Justice and they showed us a translation that they had received from the research department of the ACDAS. And Mr. Tarzide and I had a look at it. We were the two new members that just come aboard. The rest had seen it prior to the election. And we looked at this and we said that this is so distant from Shoghi Effendi. And we made some comment about that, and they said, yes, well, the committee said they couldn't imitate Shoghi Effendi, so they wouldn't try it. They'd create a new style. And both of us kind of, recoiled at that, and we said, but we understood that the Guardian, in translating the Igon, had, he has this prefatory note about that he'd hoped that this would help future generations. So we would like to recommend that the translation of the Akdas, especially as a third of it was already translated by Shoghi Effendi, should come in conformity with his style and usage. Well, that seemed reasonable to the House of Justice. They took a vote on that. Of course, that immediately hampered the old translation that was the new, the translation was being proposed. So they said they wanted a committee of the House of Justice to then review and revise the translation in conformity with this principle. And they said, and you will be the convener of that. And they pointed to me. I've been on the House about 3 days, and I thought, and your co members of the committee will be Ali Nakhchivani and Hushman Fathi Azam and Ian Semple and Peter Kahn and Adib Tarzadi. Thank you very much. Anyway, as it worked out, basically I was the note taker in the meeting. I would say, Ali, I think you better chair this. This is beyond my capacity here at this moment, because of the Arabic or something. I'd make some excuse. So he'd usually chair the meeting. Then we met in my office for two half-day meetings a week for 4 years doing the revision, six House members. And my office had the biggest bookcase and amount of books in it, and we had them all over the table and had a big table in there to do these revisions. It was fascinating. And I asked the House of Justice, would they suspend this operation for 3 to 4 months while we composed a computer program, which was called CTA, Computerized Translator's Aid, in which the original writings were matched and linked word by word and phrase by phrase with Shoghi Effendi's translations. That gave us then a broad basis to search out words and phrases to see the context and to understand how he had translated these same terms. And I must say, in the course of doing this, we'd do a few verses each time we met and look at them and look at the precedents of the Guardian and propose new possible revisions. And sometimes we discover the whole meaning of a verse was quite different from what previously had been thought. And it was a tremendous experience. I'd come early in the morning with another Persian worker who was there and would do these searches and print out all the usages and contexts in which Shoghi Effendi translated the words that were in those verses that were coming up that for that meeting. And then we'd go through this and gradually we built up a new translation, or revised translation, if you will, of the Akdas. And that was probably two and a half years maybe into the process. And then we sent it out to 18 independent readers, people like Marzia Gale, non-Baha'i professors at the University of Chicago, all kinds of people, to ask their views on the translation, the quality of the translation, the usage, and collected back the ones most all of them answered. Some of them sent whole new translations of the book back to us. It wasn't very helpful, but it did give you some ideas for the phrasing. So we check and double check against that. And then we made a list of verse by verse with all the exceptions, what had been said and the notes from each of them compiled chronologically or, you know, in the order of the book, sequentially of the Akdas itself. And then we went through as a committee and reviewed all of those and saw which we felt were valid and could be proposed and inserted and changed the order of words sometimes in the meaning, and held our ground because we had firm precedent from Shoghi Effendi sometimes. And that was fascinating until we got a book, The Six of Us, that, and some of the other members would kind of smile at this, that we then submitted to the other three for final approval. Six of us already having said that this is it, it's kind of, you know, like majority vote. So, but we had interesting times and we all discussed them, and finally we had it. Now the last year of that process was building the notes, and we had different people working on the notes, proposing to us what notes, a look at all the supplementary tablets related to verses of the Akdas, where either Baha'u'llah had something independently on it, or those passages that Baha'u'llah in his tablet said this constitutes a part, this is not in the Akdas, but it constitutes part of the Kitab-i Akdas. One very important paragraph about the House of Justice was there. And the obligatory prayers, which were supplementary, because the original obligatory prayer for the Akdas had gone missing. And it had been replaced by Baha'u'llah before it went missing. But it was in the satchel that Muhammad Ali took from Abdu'l-Baha just after the passing of Baha'u'llah. So we've never seen that back again. But that was, you know, he said we reduced the number of the prayers prescribed by the Bab to 9. I think we had found in the Bayan and so on, I think there were 19 original obligatory prayers to say a day. Well, that seemed like a lot, and Baha'u'llah had graciously brought that down. There were comments that he had even had from other prophets in the spiritual world saying, you know, as a mercy, bring this down, and so on. Interesting question. So those things were all compiled, and that became the section of the notes that you see at the end of the Kitab-i Akdas. And that's a very important part of the book. It clarifies all kinds of things. Of course, we had the notes of the Guardian in his synopsis and his first efforts at the codification of the Akdas. And except for two entries in that, that the House of Justice added, that stayed the way the Guardian had made it. We had it in the Guardian's own hand. And that was first published, as you know, by the House of Justice earlier on, the codification and synopsis and codification of the Kitab-i Aqdas, with the passage that Shoghi Effendi translated of the Aqdas. So in the end, just after the Holy Year, we were able to design a book and publish the book, prototype that we sent out then to the National Assemblies. And that's pretty much the same process happened with Summons of the Lord of Hosts, and then with Gems, and finally the Tabernacle of Unity. Those were all where things were. But the committee was greatly reduced from 6 to 4, 3 or 4 people for those other books, because it didn't have the, you know, the far-reaching implications of the Kitab-i Aqdas. And besides that, we'd worked out a pattern whereby the translators and the different people that contributed originally would do the same thing that the committee had done now. They were doing it and producing something in the spirit and character of Shoghi Effendi's work, Shoghi Effendi's translations. Yeah.
I was wondering how it fits with the translation. I understand recently that the O God, refresh and guide my spirit has been taken out of the prayer book and is no longer considered an authentic writing of Abdu'l-Bahá.
Well, it was never considered an authentic writing of Abdu'l-Bahá, but it was in the prayer book and it was everybody's favorite prayer, so we left it for years. But then we did a thorough search and we can't find any justification to. There's no original text for it. That may still show up, who knows, but we haven't been able to find one. And if you notice that against every other prayer of Abdu'l-Bahá, you know, thou art more firm than I am to myself, prayers don't usually end that way. There were things about it, but it's a beautiful prayer. You can still use the prayer, just don't attribute it to Abdu'l-Bahá, that's all. An equally powerful shake-up, O God, unite the hearts of thy servants, there's no basis for that either. But that, those were such... Those were the ones everybody had memorized. Yes, Sherna's suggesting they may be in the satchel that Muhammad Ali's, in which case they're not probably going back in the prayer book again. So, yeah.
I noticed in the reading of One Common Faith that it sounds like Shoghi Effendi, the House of Justice's presentation. Was this on purpose? The word, because just parts of it reading, it's very close to the style.
Well, that wasn't an intention. It was written with all sincerity, and I suppose we're all influenced by how the Guardian wrote, so it would tend to have that, at least that reach for that tone and quality. Yeah, please.
Are there instances with the House of Justice where they make decisions or make comments and then world events sort of take a turn, that there's a connection between what the House of Justice decides and what happens in the world later?
No, but I know Mr. Saba took note that whenever he'd do some major earth moving on the mountain of God, something would go wrong in the rest of the world, you know. So he used to point that out from time to time, and there were a lot of coincidences of starting the, you know. Please, someone over here.
I was wondering if you could describe a little bit about the actual consultation of the House of Justice and what that was like to be a part of that, the level of consultation that the members have there, and maybe some of the attributes or virtues that are present.
You know, yeah, I could probably do that, but you'd have to, first of all, accept, obviously, it's just my own point of view, because even the sometimes a letter would come, House had made a decision, somebody would write and say, why did the House decide that? Or how did you decide that? Why did you decide? And there's no way for the member to answer that kind of a question. Would have to submit it back to the House, and they would have to establish or legislate why it is they decided that in complete unity. Because I voted for something because, well, I thought that was good for this or that, and someone said, oh, I did that because of Germany. And you don't know what the motives are, but so all of that leads to this confirmed guided decisions that the House of Justice has, and you all are probably well aware there's no red light that blinks in the middle of the table when you get it right. You have to, I remember crossing crossing with Glenford Mitchell in the hall before I was on the House of Justice, and he was looking kind of haggard, and I said, "Oh, you look tired. Are you okay?" He said, "Infallibility is hard work." He said. And I found out about that too. So when I was first on the House of Justice, I had a tour of America that was already booked as a teaching center member. And then I was on the House of Justice. So I said, "The House of Justice, what do I do? I've got this promise to speak at the youth conference in Indiana and here and there." And so they said, "Go, just go. It's fine." So along the way, I said, "I'm a new enough House member that I will dare comment on my first experiences with the House of Justice, because probably later on you're not going to get it out of me." And the things that I said at that time were that everything moves so fast that you hardly, at first you don't know quite what's happening. We walked off the platform, applause, House members coming off the platform, it's a lunch break. The person with the highest number of votes was Mr. Nakhchivani at election. He turned to the rest of us and says, 2 o'clock in room 109 upstairs for a meeting. So we went into this room for a meeting of the House of Justice. It was a makeup table or something, you know, it was backstage in this auditorium. It didn't seem like a very suitable setting for the House of Justice. There were two bathrooms available because it was all men. And we sat at the table and the chairman said, "Welcome to the two members. Could we have an opening prayer, please?" That was just that simple. And then he said, "There's a cable here from Jerusalem. The government has asked the following question. We have to answer it now. We can't wait for meeting next Monday." And that was what the meeting was about. And we discussed that and several other points related to the holy day in the afternoon, and that was the end of it. But I noticed as they were talking about the different issues, they would talk about it and so on, and then the chairman would introduce a new issue. And we go on and discuss that, and then he'd introduce another issue. So I was kind of scratching my head, when does the vote take place, or why? So I asked one of the members, he said, "No, this is the way we operate. If you are not in agreement with what's been said, the last thing that's been said is what's the decision. So if somebody adds a caveat, if nobody responds to that and says yes, but not too heavy, or whatever might be on the wording that we're talking about, then that remains the decision." So I think, you know, in 22 years, I've been involved in two times we voted. That was a terrific excitement about that particular issue, whatever it was. And I used to say that the only thing I could compare this to is when we were kids. I don't think they do that anymore. But when we were kids, we used to play with mercury in boxes, you know, and it would flash around and join and rejoin. And that was the consultation. Mercurial is the way I would describe the consultation of the House of Justice. You come to the meeting, you know, before you come there, of course, the day before, you've got the agenda, 3 pages of single line items, all completely at variance with each other, you know? The modification of or application of some law of Baha'u'llah, the burning down of the Hazir in some country, the misbehavior of one of the youth at the World Center, the it's just any endless thing. The budget was short for buying the new truck for the gardens at Baji. We've got to supplement it, like that. So there was no organization of the items. While I was on the House of Justice, we had an urgent and then a normal agenda items. But I mean, I must say, practically everything on the House of Justice was urgent. So pretty soon people wanted their things attended to. The different members would bring items. Each one of us had, like, portfolios. We'd bring the subjects to the agenda, hear the decision of the House of Justice, and then we would be in charge of producing drafts to bring back to the House of Justice for approval, final approval of the decision. Because most everything was decided in writing, I mean. But we didn't make formal minutes, because the minutes then... So the members would remember, so you're there every day, all day. You remember the discussion we had yesterday on this decision. Now here's a draft letter, and you say, yes, but this doesn't reflect the aspect of that. But it's very seldom that happened. The members were very skilled at putting into the letter the spirit of what the House of Justice wanted, even when it was the opposite of the way they presented the issue to start with. That's what I found very interesting. They would just don't waste anybody's time, including my own, with a draft that I'm trying to, you know, push something in a certain direction. It's not going to go there. So then that would be fixed and finally initialed by the members and would go out the door. And usually we didn't finish the agenda. I mean, we worked through it. And sometimes we had breakthroughs in the agenda where a new item would come in. This was the way this whole supplementary plan for the Eastern Bloc countries and Russia came into the meeting kind of sideways on some other issue. And then we got more and more excited about it and talked about it 3 hours or so, and it formalized this thing and made a message the next day and sent it out to the wider world, the supplement to the plan of that period. It operates in a way that you can't really conceive unless you're there. And I don't think anybody has a clue about the pressures that the House members feel under that, getting it done the right way and doing the right thing by every issue that comes up. And then oftentimes you get the agenda and there's that much backup behind it, because it's all the previous letters sent out on this subject that the House of Justice has written are there, so you can understand what the House of Justice said previously, so that you don't introduce infallible contradiction of its decisions. That wouldn't be helpful for anybody. So, fortunately, you know, we got about 1,000 letters. Shoghi Effendi says that's a subject should refer to the House of Justice. There's just endless kinds of things like that. So, some of the Baha'is were concerned that the House of Justice might drift from its sphere of jurisdiction and legislation. And yet, Shoghi Effendi has said himself in the dispensation that will never, neither the guardian nor the would ever veer from their defined areas. But the guardian was supposed to also have the power then to tell the House of Justice if he thinks this area is something that he should be doing or so on. But now, in the absence of a guardian, the House of Justice has to look very carefully at the text to see what there is there, and is able, has a terrific freedom. Nobody can define, people have tried to define the infallibility of the House of Justice. Nobody but the House of Justice really has the authority to consider that matter. And it's written several letters, important letters on the subject, some of which you'll find in the collected letters of the House of Justice. Yes, in the back, please.
Yeah, I really appreciate your putting the fourth of our time here, that just to make it good. I know you're writing another book. Can you tell us about what your next book is about?
Well, it's just kind of in the nebulous stage. I'm not very much of a writer. I usually speak. And so I get transcripts of what I say, and then other people help to edit the transcripts. They take all these ideas and stick them together and put them in some kind of sequence, and then I work on that afterwards. And this, it's a series of talks on immortality, the meaning of eternal life and the human soul, and just trying to, you know, add a little to that. I'm hoping sometime within the next 10 years. The other one took 20 years. This Forces of Our Time took more than 20 years. So, but, you know, I don't know how good I'll be at editing it at 94 or something, so I have to be a little careful. I'll try to rush it along. That's a kind of a sweet way of saying don't hold your breath. I may see the end of the story before the middle, you know. So. Please.
That subject that gives me the courage to ask this question, in light of guidance, you quote something which I voiced in 40 years of enlightenment, that the evil exerts a very strong influence both in this world and the next.
Yes.
You know, maybe if you run halfway through the process, we build science and we tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was just trying to think about that, because we noticed when we're putting together this compilation, that was going to see the question would come up, what does it mean? And if you put that next to the statement of Abdu'l-Bahá that he says, heaven and hell exist in all the worlds of God, you realize that there's a negative element of, there is perpetuity of souls, Abdu'l-Bahá says. There's no annihilation of souls. So everybody goes to the next world. Some go terribly evil and wicked, and their condition embodies darkness and evilness and remoteness from God in that world. So the fact that we say both, you know, light and darkness exist in all the worlds, is, I think it's that dimension of it. And we have phrases of from tablets saying, like, Baha'u'llah says there are angels that are assigned to help lift the souls. And Abdu'l-Bahá himself says in one of the statements that he makes in the Memorials of the Faithful, that he's writing about a certain man. He said, I had a dream about him the other night, and I saw him, and he was still quite corpulent and jolly as usual, and he'd just come back. He said he'd come back from a very interesting district where he was diffusing the fragrances of God. And there's a footnote that says that's the name for teaching in the next world, diffusing the fragrances of God. He'd gone to this area to diffuse the fragrances of God, and he found they had all kinds of interesting new foods and fruits in that area, which he found fascinating. Which, you know, all of these things together, there's a chapter in this book about activities in the next world. What do we do in the next world? You know, you get this image of playing music on clouds, and, you know, that kind of, there isn't much of that in the writings. So if you're not musically inclined, don't feel too bad about it. And obviously the souls, he says, the more advanced souls seek to lift the other souls through the powers of God. And they serve as the detached souls, the really detached souls, serve as the leaven for the arts and sciences in this world. So obviously they retain an interest in it. And, you know, it's not all sweetness and light. Look at Baha'u'llah talks about sitting in the company of the prophets, and they're weeping over what is happening to him in this world. He has dreams of what's going on in the other world, sees that and talks about it. And that the concourse on high are rending their garments because of the treatment of somebody's doing to the prophets of God in this world and so on. So it's, there's some, sounds like some high adventure, you know. It's not all light and mercy alone. Please, yeah, I don't know who else. I think you're here.
I just have a question. We came back from the eighth chapter, and we have discussed a lot of that, but there's one part of it that I was left with a question. And it said in we should have resolved the constant fight against four categories of things, and the categories were inherent tendencies, corruptive instincts, fluctuating fashions, and false pretenses. And I thought to myself, well, you know, some of those might have one or two obvious meanings, but what was your intent behind that? Or what do you understand about these categories of qualities that we have to self-examine?
No, it kind of covers a great quantity of sins and shortcomings, doesn't it? I think, you know,
it's not very specific.
No, but there are some specific things when you start looking at the guardian's list of the forces of darkness. Again, then it comes to see, well, do I have, what am I, how am I doing with those qualities? And yeah.
Did I go in a cold book or something? But were we going to study, or you were talking about prayer, meditation, studying?
Yes. Okay. I'll end up with that maybe. What do we got? We have a few more minutes. Please.
Closure of Mysore International Baha'i School came rather unexpectedly for especially those of us who have children going there, of course, after
graduation.
So I was just wondering if you were willing to use the
All I can say is that the principal reason was economic in character. The school was not making any money, not that it needed to, but it wasn't paying its expenses. And also it became clear that of the schools in the area, the Maxwell School had the lowest academic standing. And that didn't feel right to the National Assembly, the Canadian National Assembly. So rather than not doing a perfectly outstanding job of it, maybe we should, in the face of the financial crisis that they were facing, to not be able to pay for the school. Because they had donors in the past that had given lots of money, and that ran out, and then that it had trouble. So I think it's more from a practical point of view than anything else. No doubt these schools will come back in the future. I mean, it's clear. Please.
I'm wondering, it's such a unique experience living in the Holy Land and serving in the House of Justice and the counselors. I'm just wondering if you could maybe share with us some of your, what strikes as sort of, not process, but personal development, and what on earth must it be like, you know, on a personal level to be in that sort of company and environment, and changes perhaps you noticed or awarenesses you've learned from, you know, other members, or just how it affects you, if you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Nothing jumps to mind. It's a life process. I mean, we were there 37 years. It's a whole lifetime. You could talk to my wife about the changes. That she'd probably have more candid things to say than I would. I remember I mean, there were interesting moments. I remember Ian Semple. We used to give talks to the pilgrims. You know, we take turns giving talks to the pilgrims. So one time Ian Semple said to me, he said, oh, I had a terrible dream. I said, what was it? He said, I dreamt I was speaking to the pilgrims. And one of the pilgrims asked me, Mr. Semple, what about these paper assemblies? You know, we had this term paper assemblies. We were churning out assemblies everywhere, and they weren't really, the Baha'is weren't aware exactly of what the institution was and so on. And he says, when they asked me that, I said, local or national? That was his bad dream. Every once in a while you see a National Assembly slip off the charts and they become an administrative committee. And you can only imagine. Yes, please. Mr. Baluzzi himself? Mr. Baluzzi, of course, was an Afnan, which distinguishes him amongst the hands. And he was from Iran. He was active in the, came to the UK very early on when he was young, and he became part of the BBC Persian service. And he was very interested in literary things, and he did a lot of research, mainly working with Mujan Momen, who's still around and active, who would collect these things, and then they gradually built up these books. He passed away just before finishing these eminent Baha'is, and Mujan finished it for him because he knew the spirit of where it was going, and they were waiting on translations of different things that were included in that. But it's a terrific contribution, you know. There's a lot of information in King of Glory, particularly. The writings of the Bab, not so much, but King of Glory. And some of the things that are in the writings of the Bab have come from memoirs of the family, of family members. And he was a very distinguished man, a very wonderful man. I met him in Haifa in 63. He was the one that told me, we've chosen you to be a reader at the feast this afternoon. He had organized the program with the Hands of the God. Yeah. Oh, my heavens. Oh, God, help me. Help me. Well, I use the revealed prayers and try to follow the example that they give. Thank you. I don't pray as much as I should, I'm sure. I mean, sometimes I think I don't pray as much as I should.
I want to clarify that question. Was it personal or from the Universal House of Justice when they were praying as they
thought? Oh, you're making a new question.
Personal.
Personally, yeah. I answered it personally. The House of Justice will respond to requests for prayers. I don't think we should think of them having a list that you can put your name on the list. That they discourage that. But, you know, people write and say, you know, we have this situation in my family, or there's illness, or there's this, or so-and-so's passed away. And the House will assure the people of prayers. And if you have an assurance of prayers from the House of Justice, then your issue or your family or the member or the person that's being prayed for is mentioned in the shrines by the House of Justice out loud. It's not just, oh yeah, we'll pray for you, you know, like we say to each other, so I'll pray for you. The angels are listening. There's those that take down notes of everything we do. You know, Baha'u'llah says this. There's an order of angels. He said that all they do is take down the actions of men. And women, I think, I presume, but it says men. Please. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's accurate. Kind of where's that at, and kind of what's still arriving? How much has been translated, and what's next? And I also heard that the Seven Dallas is being retranslated.
Well, you're talking to somebody who's been out of the center of things for a year now, more than a year. So I don't know the latest on any of this. But I know the general tendencies. You're right about the 10% or so, but the 10% are the most important works of Baha'u'llah. And some of the other ones that are coming along are the ones that are mentioned in God Passes By. The most important works of Baha'u'llah we've taken to be those that Shoghi Effendi has specified in God Passes By. There's all kinds of other tablets. There's some of the tablets are actually of a menial nature, but they oftentimes have some celestial gem in it. You know, Baha'u'llah writes to, or is a tablet written on his behalf to so-and-so living near the South Bazaar in Istanbul. Baha'u'llah requesting, go to the corner of so-and-so and get from so-and-so that cheese that they make in the what province and send some for us in the Holy Land. The Holy Family wants, the women want it. Then he'll add on something, may the hosts on high bless your efforts to do this and to do that, and besides buying the cheese. And and something's there that has some heavenly significance. Quite fascinating. But we're not going to make a book out of it right away. That's for sure. So the House has to decide, you know, what are the kind of things, passages mostly they're gleaning, and oftentimes those come out in the compilations that you've seen over the years. If you combine all the previously untranslated passages from the compilations that the House has published in English, you've got another book of selections, interesting things to look at. And I'm sure gradually, it's not all emphasis on making new books right at the moment. Seven Valleys was submitted to a retranslation, and Four Valleys, well, whether there's something will be done with it right away, I don't know. There are some questions about the translation, particularly Four Valleys, that the Guardian wasn't very complimentary about. Needs to be looked at. And there's no such book as Seven Valleys and Four Valleys. Those are two independent tablets that approach the subjects they approach in a different way. So that's useful to remember. Some Answered Questions has also been retranslated. That's a very important work, and that's been going on for a decade anyway. And I think that should perhaps come to a conclusion very shortly also. It originally been planned for the centenary, 2008, of that was kind of the aim of the translators, but it had to go through various reviews. You don't want to substitute a translation that then has to be substituted again after a while. So there have been extra efforts to bring it into conformity with. Yes?
So my introduction, I just brought $42 to $7 in the four values, a new book that I just...
Yeah, Julio Savi's book?
Yeah, is that going to like be moved after?
Well, I suppose it'll get revised because of translation variations in the phrasing, but it's not, you know, Seven Values is pretty much on the money. It's just not, it didn't have the benefit of this CTA program, of the Guardian's translations of the writings of Baha'u'llah. So. And there were some notes from Shoghi Effendi early on, student notes, that also had a bearing on the, particularly on the preamble there that is from the Arabic, and there's other things that contributed to that. I was telling somebody that we found a reference, Shoghi Effendi translated, "The steed of this valley of search." He didn't put patience, he put fortitude, which is a variation on sabr that one wouldn't come to mind right away, but makes so much more sense because it's active and not just sit and patiently search, you know. It just didn't seem to match. So there are things like that that might get addressed. Well, prayer, meditation, study, and action. Just the sense of it is that the number of times it was mentioned by the Guardian, how much the reinforcement of our inner resources is important so that the action will be effective. So this question of to study and to teach, these two are so interrelated. Baha'u'llah says, you know, if you're going to teach, first teach your own self. And he provides then the means through the tablets for us to do that. But we can't sit and... You know how it says when you deepen in the faith, you find that your previous thoughts were erroneous. Well, if we all waited for the erroneous things to finish, we would never teach anybody. So we have to teach on the basis of what we know. And this is the idea, I think, of the Rui program too, is it provides a basis, a sufficient basis for action. So as you can feel comfortable, more people will feel comfortable being able to share the faith. None of us have read the 6 million words of Baha'u'llah. So who's deepened, you know? And yet, according to our capacities, we know how little we're familiar with the Kitab-i-Ghan, for example, or have we made a study of spiritual significances from prayers and meditations? I always think prayers and meditations of Baha'u'llah is a terrific book to study, not just to recite prayers. This is the first time we have the meditations of the manifestation of God about his own condition and his own experiences. And we read along and we find a prayer and we says, "Oh, thou seest me shut up in my prison." Oh, that's not me. My prison house, that's not me. That's for the manifestation. We send it back to him. He has revealed it. Shoghi Effendi has chosen it. He's translated it because that educates us on the state of the manifestation, the relationship of the manifestation, the outer manifestation of God with his inner reality and with the essence of God. So they're very important things. Even go through and mark them in your prayers and meditations and read them all as a go to see what is it, why have they been included? There's a lot of them there. So that's the study. And the prayers and meditations, the Guardian used to say in those days to the pilgrims, he said, you should pray and meditate like the Persians. They were very devoted and consecrated the way they did their prayers. They had, of course, you know, what, a century head start on us, lots of them, and martyrs in their families and all these things that would made them really solid Baha'is in that spiritual sense. And then he said the study of the faith, they should follow the example of the Germans. The Germans, he said, they're anything but superficial. And of course, we had two hands of the cause, Dr. Grossman and Dr. Muschlegel, who were great scholars of the faith and had studied the writing systematically, and that was an example for us all. And then he said that an act, and this was the early 50s and the mid-50s, America had gone out and Americans had moved to more goals than any other people in the world to fulfill the plan, and so he said, act like the Americans. In the sense of getting up and doing something. I think there's other things you don't need to copy. And the whole picture then is the equilibrium, he said, the balance between these elements in our life. Do we pray enough? Do we meditate enough? Do we study enough so that our action will be effective? Well, this is basically the message of that, of those phrases. You can find, you can search in the system and find the references to them. There's a whole lot of them. I haven't done it. I'd like to. I have some of them collected, but it would be interesting to see them all. Okay, friends, we've come to the end of the day here, and it really, I'm so happy to see you all and to meet you all, and you'll forgive me if I don't remember you next time I see you. You may remember me, but I may not remember you. I've got a lot more people to remember than you do. And but I have enjoyed the interchanges that we've had together. And my wife also has enjoyed them. I have to speak on her behalf because she won't open her mouth right now. Do you have anything to say, honey? No. No, she said no. Okay, that sums it up for the moment. Thank you.